This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Well, it's Wednesday, the 7th of May. I'm Alec Hogg. Here's your briefing for the day. We get straight to it. Late yesterday afternoon, I suppose, early evening, around 7:30, I had an opportunity to chat with the executive mayor of Cape Town, Jordan Hill Lewis. It's a fabulous interview. It's up on BizNews TV on YouTube. I strongly recommend you go and have a look at this rising star. He's only 38 and he's already achieved so much in politics. Don't forget, he was the shadow minister of finance. So if they're looking for a replacement for Enoch Godongwana, he certainly might be the one who would have his hat in the ring anyway. And Jordan is doing a really good job as the mayor of Cape Town. I asked him about something that Rob Herzog raised last week, where he said that the way to negotiate with the Americans is to say that the Western Cape is DA run. The DA agrees with what the American values are. The ANC runs the rest of the country. They disagree with American values, or certainly up to this point. And as a consequence, if the United States is going to impose sanctions on South Africa, and as you'll hear later, there's been quite a lot of progress in that regard over the last 24 hours. If that's going to happen, then keep the Democratic Alliance run Western Cape, and indeed the city of Cape Town, out of it. Give them a free pass. Opposed that view to Jordan Hill Lewis and asked him a little bit about his thoughts on geopolitics right now.
The values on which prosperity are built, the values of a free and competitive market, the values of a free speech and liberty and a constant effort to expand individual freedoms. In other words, the values which have defined America's incredible prosperity over the last century or so. Those are the values represented by the Democratic Alliance in South Africa. Now, the best possible outcome for the ANC would be if they were able to cast themselves as victims. They love that. If you just think about how they associate with all of those their close association with the kind of Cuban cause in inverted commas, and how they position themselves as victims of American dominance, and take no responsibility for the absolute demolition job that left-wing and socialist ideology has done to that country. So the best possible outcome for the ANC is if they were placed in a position where they could paint themselves as victims, without any regard to the consequences of the country, because that's always last on the ANC's mind. It's all about how they can position themselves. And so I don't think that Donald Trump's victimization and targeting of South Africa helps actually to advance the values the same values which have generated so much prosperity and success in the United States of America. If he's interested in supporting those values and seeing those values come to the fore and come to the surface in South Africa, then he should not so easily place the ANC in a position where they are able to say, well, we can't take any responsibility for the disaster in South Africa because we're a victim of that scapegoat again. So I just offer that as a word of caution. As for engaging with them directly, I've got no objection to that. I mean, we must, I've always said we must fight for the interests of Cape Town and the Cape Town business community, and more broadly, the Western Cape business community and agricultural community. And most importantly, we must fight for the interests of Western Cape workers and people who are still to be workers, unemployed people who are desperately looking for a job. And so if we can engage in a constructive way to cool down temperatures and perhaps stop the vindictive tweets about South Africa, then I think that we can really have a positive impact. I'll give you one practical example of why this is important and why I wouldn't hesitate to engage. It's always better to engage. We've got a hotel developer right here in the city who has pushed pause on R1 billion hotel development, a brand new R1 billion hotel in the city. He's pushed pause on that development because he said there is just too much instability around South Africa coming from our relationship with the United States. And he is banking on that hotel being filled with American tourists in the main. There's real world consequences to these things, and job consequences for many people who desperately need them. So I wouldn't hesitate to engage.
Lovely stuff. And you wonder where you find such wisdom in a 38-year-old. Well, Jordan Hill Lewis is going to be with us for quite some time, one hopes, and with that kind of approach towards things, lower the temperature. Explain to Trump that what you're doing right now is actually just making matters worse because you're feeding the victim mentality of those who would thrive on it. But it is interesting that Jordan Hill Lewis is not alone. The Afrikaner Bond announced this morning, and my colleague Chris Steyn will be having an interview in due course with Tiens Eloff, who's on the Afrikaner leadership grouping, that they have met overnight with the ANC, the PAC, AfriForum, Solidarity Movement, and the SAAI, the agricultural organization that's also been very critical. It's a little bit about bringing jaw, where there's just been war, and exactly what Jordan was saying a moment ago, reducing the temperature. Well, another South African who is doing his bit in trying to find out exactly how this impasse with the United States of America that really threatens hundreds of thousands of jobs in this country, and please, Pretoria, just wake up to that reality. This is not play politics. This is the reality. If South Africa gets kicked out of the AGOA agreement, and indeed, if there's a 30% duty on South African goods, which is due to be imposed in just 60 days' time, hundreds of thousands of jobs are at risk and probably will go. And in a country that's already got the world record unemployment rate, we can ill afford to even contemplate that kind of issue. But you might recall that at the Paris Olympics, a BizNews Tribe member, John Cunha, took us in there and got into areas where most people would not have been able to see. In a way, he was our roving reporter, although he didn't go with a BizNews badge. And the result of that was that we, as a community, got to see a heck of a lot more that was going on at the Olympics than even people on television. Well, Anthony Ginsberg, the founder of Gins Global, a South African who's been living in California for 25 years, did the same thing for us over the past week in Washington. He met with the former Trump trade representative and indeed his successor, the man who's now back in the headlines, the guy he calls Jamie Greer, the current U.S. trade representative, who you'll hear later in the program is on his way to negotiate with the Chinese. I had a chat with Anthony this morning, and let's just pick up on some of the highlights.
Frankly, the guys I was talking to, the former Minister of Trade or the U.S. trade representative here who I met, there's a big misunderstanding about South Africa at the moment. They don't understand that up to 500,000 jobs could be lost potentially if AGOA goes south. And that seems to come up a lot about South Africa's role in Southern Africa. Is South Africa still a friend of the U.S. or are we in the China camp and the Middle Eastern camp? So that comes up a lot. I must say, in every single meeting I had in D.C., with financial and trade experts, they're looking at it all through a Chinese lens. They want the U.S. to no longer be dependent on China. There's this massive trade deficit, as you know. You've been reporting on it for years. It's about $400 billion roughly a year with China. But South Africa's actually got a growing surplus with the Trump White House. So we actually could be in the dog box because we've actually grown through AGOA, our trade surplus by about 45% over the last couple of years.
I was mulling this over before coming to this interview. What about a delegation of Adrian Gore, Fani Titi, Brian Joffe, Trevor Manuel, Sipho Nkosi? They've all had huge business experience. They all know the US really well. They know how American business works. And if you've got a commercial White House, bloody hell, send a commercial team to deal with them.
Absolutely. Those are all wonderful ambassadors and guys that should certainly serve on a business delegation. I believe people of that ilk can certainly cut a deal, that there's interest in a deal being done within the next 60 days. You've got to remember, America is not sustainable on the fiscal path it's currently on. The reason Trump has all the support, whether it's the DOGE, which we can discuss, the wastage and the abuse, it all comes down to that we have an unsustainable fiscal deficit. Right now, the annual deficit in the States is 6.7, almost 7% a year. It's not sustainable. The other quick one is the debt to GDP is over 120%. Trump is actually under immense pressure by the working class voters that actually elected a Republican. It's the first time the working class have actually voted in droves, including Hispanics and Blacks, for a Republican. He's under pressure to actually deliver. They want jobs to come back and to be reshored. So absolutely, there's an opportunity. I think the good news is if someone can seize the nettle right now, hopefully there is a sense of urgency now amongst the South African government and top business leaders that you previously mentioned to come to DC. I believe I've heard some chatter that may be on the cards. And that's the way to do it. I think just one interesting aside that I learned from the former Minister of Trade here, he claimed that the Mexican business lobby and the Indian business lobby are running rings around everybody else because they've got a permanent operations in DC. And you may have just heard that Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, overnight is now going to go with the US Trade Representative to Geneva in the next 48 hours to try cut a deal with the Chinese. And the Chinese have also got a delegation. So what's concerning is whether South Africa is at the back of the bus here. You know, there are 17, 18 other sizable countries that have already come to DC, apparently, and hopefully SA will get its act together shortly.
I spoke with Jordan Hill-Lewis last night. He's the executive mayor of Cape Town. And in our conversation, he said there is a practical implication of the political uncertainty. He has a person who has pressed pause on a hotel development of R1 billion in the city of Cape Town. And he says he's pressed pause because of this relationship between South Africa and the United States being so tenuous. What would your recommendation be to get that, given all the work that you've now done in Washington and all the people that you've seen and all the feedback that you've had, how are we going to get that guy to press the play button again on that development?
It's a great question. I think the simple answer is if South Africa could get a very simple framework trade deal done with the US, it doesn't mean it's going to be hundreds of pages long with all the copyright and intellectual issues sorted out. But if there's a framework that says, okay, we're giving the Americans some certainty that we're in the Western camp, we're going to be representing the US in good faith across the region. There might be some preferential mining or other trade arrangement with Trump. Typically, if it has a B behind it, it gets his attention very quickly. A B meaning billions of dollars. I think if there was some sort of rapprochement soon, then the Cape Town deal, I'm sure, would go ahead ASAP.
Again, some really good, sensible advice from a man on the ground. And we thank Anthony Ginsberg for sharing that with us. He went along and saw the right people, and he really, what he's saying is don't send the B team or the C team or the D team. Send in your A team, your business A team. Let them go and talk with the business guys on the other side, because that's what's happened now. Don't send tenderpreneurs and people who've been loyal to the cause over the years. Send in people who are going to be respected and who know how the ground is in the United States. And then they'll come back with a deal that our government can take, our government of national unity, remember, can take credit for. The old days of the ANC sending its pals and left-wing economists supposedly to talk to business people just doesn't cut it in this day and age. And we are getting nailed, as Anthony says, we're at the back of the bus. And it's possible. Even the worst situations can be turned around very quickly. You will know that the utterances that Donald Trump made about Canada becoming the 51st state, and in particular Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister, rallied Canadians to vote in the Liberal Party, who under Trudeau were going to get a hammering in the elections. And the new head of the Liberal Party, a new Prime Minister, Mark Carney, met last night with Trump in the White House. And here's what went down.
I would venture to say Mark Carney played this one pretty well.
Yes, everyone was thinking back to the meeting with Zelensky a couple months ago that was quite tense and ended in flared tensions. None of that was there today. Even some of the, you know, animosity that Trump had shown towards Trudeau, Carney's predecessor, wasn't there. He, you know, even at a White House event just moments ago, Trump said he wasn't even going to call Carney governor, as he did with Trudeau. He, you know, mentioned the 51st state thing. Carney said, you know, no, we're not going to do that. But the both leaders were very complimentary of one another and indicated that these trade talks could move forward.
You touched on the 51st state coming up today, and he saying that he's not going to do that. You know, both men have to appeal to their constituencies about this. How is the relationship with them moving forward?
So both of them, you know, sort of kind of set the ground here. There was essentially a reset in the relationship from what we've seen between Canada and the U.S., that it's clear that both sides realize they need a deal. And even Trump, more so than he was even, you know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, was sort of saying, hey, we don't need these deals. Now it's clear that the White House is angling for some of these deals. We heard that from Scott Bessent on the Hill today. Trump said that he will be setting the terms, but it's clear that every time he's come out and said, look, we're going to negotiate, we're going to have a win here, but he really needs some of these countries and some of these deals to come through to assure markets, investors, and the Republican Party.
In the world of business banking, the bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
At SunExchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
Scott Bessent is in the news there. He's also in the news all over the wires this morning, because it has been confirmed that the trade talks between the US and China are going to happen this week. They'll be led by the US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Jamie Greer, the guy that you heard from a little earlier, from Anthony Ginsburg. Jamie Greer, who's the US trade representative. They're on their way to Switzerland for those talks. On the Chinese side, it's about as senior as it could be, with the Vice Premier He Lifeng heading their delegation. Again, here's our partners at Bloomberg.
Let us talk about those trade talks, because now we actually do have confirmation that they're going ahead. Remember, there was a lot of vagueness about whether President Trump had actually spoken to President Xi. Now we know that Treasury Secretary Bessent will be involved in those trade discussions. What can we expect out of them, Min-Min?
Yeah, it is a good sign. One of the first signs so far of both sides having coordinated messaging. As you said, the last few weeks had been a lot of confusion. Chinese and U.S. officials talking about different sets of things. This is the first time we saw both sides coordinated their messaging, both sides putting out their statements at 6 a.m. Beijing time today, acknowledging that, yes, these trade talks are finally happening in a neutral third-party country in Switzerland. He Lifeng, China's vice premier, will be overseeing those talks. That's a very high-level official. The same position. If you look at the first trade war, the trade talks were overseen by the vice premier at the time, Liu He. This time, it is He Lifeng. So that's a good sign that this is happening at the highest level possible, aside from, you know, the top leaders coming out to speak to each other themselves. And expectations are high, of course. Anticipation around, you know, what the U.S. will offer, to what extent are they going to lower tariffs. And meanwhile, Chinese Commerce Ministry also releasing a statement again saying that U.S. needs to show its sincerity, that it needs to be the one to remove all unilateral tariffs here.
There is a danger that South Africa is at the back of the bus, as Anthony Ginsburg said a little bit earlier. And it even China and the U.S. in lockstep now about what needs to be done. Just so that you understand, over the last 20 years, China has been, well, eating up the United States. It has had duty-free access into the U.S. markets. It's chewed up many of the U.S. jobs, and Donald Trump is saying no more. And as a consequence of that, there are the tensions. And here we are in South Africa, not kind of understanding these geopolitical issues, and maybe sucking the hind tit as a result of it. Well, a country that is very much in the vanguard of the way the world is changing is Argentina. And a good reflection of this is the decision by Argentina's president, Javier Milei, to not only cut government, but to encourage investment. Our partners at the Financial Times of London put together this super interesting report for the FT News Briefing this morning.
Mendoza province in Argentina is mostly known for one thing, wine. It's probably where your last glass of Malbec came from. But lately, this vineyard-drenched region is looking to exploit another red treasure, copper. New economic conditions under Argentina's president, Javier Milei, have helped spur a mining rush in the country. My colleague Kira Nugent visited the area and is here to tell me more. Hey, Kira.
Hi, Mark.
So talk to me about Mendoza. How did a region recognized for wine find itself at the center of a copper mining blitz?
Yes. Yeah, so as you say, Mendoza is very famous for wine. And if you've ever been to Mendoza, you'll know that the vineyards that you'll have lunch in and drink some Malbec in are kind of in the shadow of the Andes Mountains. And those are the same mountains that in Peru and Chile, Argentina's neighbors in the region, have become like a hub of copper mining. But Mendoza has never really wanted to mine copper from the Andes because it's very concerned about its water resources. Mining, as you may know, has a very heavy water usage and has been linked to polluting water in other parts of South America. And Mendoza has never wanted to risk its resources for communities and for wineries either. But there's now a kind of shift happening because of economic conditions.
Yeah, tell me more about the timing of all this. What's changed to make copper mining more palatable in Argentina?
So for Mendoza specifically, the industries that it's historically relied on, including wine, are in decline because of a drop in global alcohol consumption. But for Argentina more generally, there's this big kind of push to get copper out of the ground. Because over the last 30 years, while Peru and Chile were really ramping up copper mining, Argentina has been so economically unstable and had these big political swings. So miners haven't really wanted to come to the country. But now you're seeing President Javier Milei is kind of stabilizing the economy and providing all these incentives to investors. And at the same time, provincial leaders who have a lot of control over their mining resources are dropping opposition for their own economic reasons.
Okay, so wine sales are slumping. There's an interest in mining copper in Argentina. How big could copper mining get in the country?
Yeah, so the energy transition is driving huge demand for copper because it's a key component of electrical wiring, wind turbines. So in Argentina as a whole, there are six kind of advanced projects in the pipeline that could actually catapult Argentina from producing almost no copper at the moment comfortably into the top 10 producers in the early 2030s. We're talking about like about a million tons of copper a year.
Wow, a million tons a year? Kira, how do vineyard owners feel about all this copper potentially being mined in their backyard?
Yeah, I mean, historically, vineyard owners have been a source of opposition to mining. They haven't wanted to compete for water or labor resources. But now, like the ones I've spoken to basically seem okay with it. They say that if the technology is efficient in terms of water use, and if the authorities are good at monitoring mining, the ones that would really be doing the lobbying to stop mining are kind of backing down.
If plans move ahead to extract more copper from Mendoza, what would it mean for President Javier Milei and Argentina's economy as a whole?
It would mean dollars. So Argentina's big problem, or one of its biggest problems for the last few years, has been that the government doesn't have enough dollars. And that causes extreme exchange rate volatility and a series of debt defaults. Milei has managed to solve that problem in the short term with a big IMF deal he secured last month. But obviously that is borrowed money. And with mining, miners would bring in kind of hundreds of millions of dollars a year in initial investment. And then once they start exporting copper, that would be like billions and billions of dollars a year, estimated by the government, I think, at around $11 billion a year for copper in the 2030s. And that kind of cash injection makes it a lot easier to imagine like maintaining a stable Argentina in the long run.
Kira Nugent is the FT's Southern Cone correspondent. Thanks, Kira.
Thanks very much.
As Kira was saying, talking about imagining, just bring it back to South Africa. We have a treasure chest of minerals that have not been mined. And the reason for that is really poor regulations and legislation, primarily the same thing that's keeping Starlink out of South Africa. The political elite are wanting that to have their turn at the trough. 30% has to be given to them before you can even get in the door. Well, those are not regulations that are affecting anything in a country like Argentina, which is steaming ahead. Come on, South Africa, we can go there too. Some news coming out of ABSA this morning is that the chair, Sele Moloko, is going to be stepping down in July, and he'll be replaced by René van Wyk. He was chief executive. I met him, in fact, while he was the interim CEO for a very brief period in 2019. René was previously with Nedbank from 1993 to 2011, and he was also the registrar of banks and head of banking supervision at the South African Reserve Bank. So a very well-qualified person indeed to be watching over what happens if your money is invested with ABSA. On to our final story for the day, and this to me was really interesting for two reasons. Firstly, Palantir is the best performer in the BizNews global portfolio. It really has shot the lights out. But secondly, Bloomberg interviewed a guy who ordinarily would not come onto their radar. His name is Amit Kukreja. He's the chief executive of a company he's called AK Media. He's got a massive YouTube channel, and one of his favorite stocks is Palantir. He's made a focus of it, an obsession almost of it. And so earlier this week, in fact, on Monday night, our time, when Palantir's results came out, it had a negative reaction by shareholders. The share price, having when it rushed up to $120, has now fallen back to the early hundreds, or just above $100. And so Caroline Hyde of our partners at Bloomberg had a chat with Amit. It really is a interesting segment and well worth watching. Let's have a look.
What did you make of the numbers today?
Hey, Carolyn, thanks for having me on the show. I've been covering the company for the better part of 5 years now, and I've been joined with a very passionate retail investor base. And there was something that retail saw in this stock when it was trading in the single digits that Wall Street did not see. Obviously, we've seen what has happened since then, and now Wall Street is buying it at a higher premium, but maybe that's because it deserves a higher premium. I mean, you're talking about a company that just did 39% year-over-year revenue growth, 71% U.S. commercial growth. The remaining deal value is up 127%. Their U.S. government business is now accelerating to 45% year-over-year growth. It's a company doing $900 million in revenue, nearly $900 million, with less than 800 customers. I know the valuation's aggressive here, but I think the growth is starting to warrant it.
Just to double-click on the market capitalization of $255 billion. Look, the stock had run, what, excessively this year, many would say, more than 60% higher. No wonder we pull back a little bit. But I'm interested in your take, perhaps with some of the analysts out there. Jeffrey's saying, look, this is really a retail trade. I'm not hearing people talking about Palantir in the institutional market in any way the same amount that we're hearing in the retail community. Is that retail resilience there?
Well, if you look at the institutional and retail ownership split, it's 50-50. So this is not Tesla in 2019 where it was 70-30. I think there's a 50-50 split. So there's obviously institutional investors that are excited about the name. But in terms of the valuation, let's take a second and step back. OpenAI is worth $300 billion on the private markets, and they're not even profitable. AIG said this a month ago at their investor day, and Palantir quoted this in their slide deck and their earnings yesterday. AIG expects the adoption of an AI-powered underwriting solution leveraging AIP, Palantir's core software offering, to double its five-year revenue CAGR from 10% to 20%. Alex Karp, the CEO of the company, has been saying that large language models largely are becoming commoditized. The implementation of them is what matters. I'm not saying the stock is cheap. I'm saying the aggressive, obviously, is the multiple is aggressive, but it might be warranted because the implementation of AI is what really matters, and Palantir is delivering those results.
I suppose some area of concern is Europe and indeed international expansion. That's going to be the catalyst that maybe does start to have people going, oh, yeah, it should be worth 56 times its 2026 revenue. When are we going to get that international edge in the same way that they've dominated the U.S.?
Well, Alex Karp has said this many times, and he said this on the earnings call yesterday. Europe is in a crisis. They are not going to survive. At least their biggest companies in the world are not going to survive unless they embrace the AI revolution. We are seeing U.S. commercial CAGR at 71% for Palantir. That is because the United States is embracing the AI revolution. Alex Karp also said yesterday that governments across the world outside of Europe are starting to increase their, at least, inquisition of Palantir software offerings as well. Palantir recently just signed a massive NATO contract for their Maven platform. I think that we are going to start to see a growth spurt, an S-curve in Europe. It might take some time because there are still cultural differences, but eventually I think that's going to come through. And when that does come through, I think that's going to be another catalyst for Palantir.
Mm. Well, that's been your briefing for today. We'll be back again tomorrow when Bronwyn Nielsen will be in the host's seat. Until then, cheerio. This Biz News briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to finance solutions that enable real growth.